All right, so much to do today at the end here of week one. Let me give you a preview of where we're going next week. So next week, we will continue to advance through the language known as C. We'll look more at functions, the first of several data structures known as arrays, and we'll also look at a problem domain, namely cryptography, as problem set two will focus on your implementation of a handful of what are called ciphers. Based on how many hands were sort of waving breeze on them on Wednesday, we've lowered the air conditioning in here, so hopefully it should be better today. HCS, the Harvard Computer Society, is a student group on campus of students, say, like myself, who like computers, and who provide not only seminars and classes throughout the year, they also provide a huge amount of the support infrastructure for you, the student body, in terms of student groups, mailing lists, web space accounts, and so forth. HCS and CS50 this year have engaged in a partnership of sorts whereby HCS will be helping out at various points during the year. The first such instance will be this coming week. We will announce at Monday's lecture and on the course's website exactly when this will be, but HCS will be offering a Unix seminar of sorts, which is meant to go beyond the scope of the course, since what we try to do as a course in the problem sets is provide you with all those commands that you need to know. What HCS is going to do is make you not only more comfortable if you are interested, but more savvy with Unix environments, showing you more esoteric commands, more advanced commands, and generally giving you a, an additional opportunity for experience with Unix and really Linux. So more on that next week. It will probably be midweek and purely optional. The Scratch Gallery, linked via the course's website, is filled with 102 projects already. The deadline is, of course, tonight, so do take a look, even if you've already submitted, at some of the works that some of your classmates have submitted. We are quite impressed by them all. Sectioning is by 7 p.m. tonight, per problem set zero. Do be sure to do that. You will receive an email by, I think Saturday or Sunday afternoon as to which section you're assigned to. Assigned sections that will therefore begin this Sunday onward, and we will certainly continue to offer office hours and virtual office hours over the course of the week. Check the course's website for the current schedule of office hours, and within a day or so, you can also look there for the schedule of virtual office hours. Recall that at our first lecture, we promised virtual office hours this year by way of a virtual terminal room. This is a quick sneak preview just so that you've seen it in action. Essentially, the process by which we hope this will benefit you is as follows. If you, the student, decide that you simply can't make physical office hours or simply like the idea of being able to tune into office hours remotely, what you can do at the hours and days that we will announce via the course's website under office hours is you can visit the virtual terminal room. You can read those directions at your leisure at some point, but the useful button is smack in the middle there. Enter. If you click that button, assuming you have the right software installed, which is a version of Java, which is explained there on that page, when you click Enter, you'll be redirected to the company's website that produces the software that Harvard has licensed for your use. You might have to click a few buttons, yes, no, approve, and those kinds of things, but you'll eventually see this Illuminate-like window. So once this has spawned, what it's going to do is log you in automatically using your name, first name and last name, into the course's virtual terminal room. What you will always see by default on the right-hand side is a reminder, a little splash screen as to how it all works. But just to give you a sense of what to expect, this is essentially a glorified chat room. So at the top left of the window, you see the people logged in. Currently myself, and in parentheses, it's ellipsed there, but it says moderator, which means I'm one of the teaching staff and have a few more capabilities in the software than a student logging in, and Jane Harvard, who we're pretending is a student and who's logged in from another computer over there. At bottom left, you have a little chat window that works much like AOL Instant Messenger or any of those kinds of programs. So you can be in the dining halls at Brain Break, you can be in your dorm rooms, you can be even off campus. So long as you have internet access, you can log into the VTR. Once you're there, what you can do is essentially this. I'm going to flip over to the other computer that's currently pretending to be Jane. Her software obviously looks almost the same. She just has fewer buttons and options. But now notice that Jane Harvard is highlighted in blue, and it explicitly says me. Well, Jane, you log into this room. You already have a question. What you do, and this is the most important button of all, is this little hand icon there, is the equivalent of raising your hand in this sort of virtual world. What's going to happen now? Oops, what are we looking at here? What's going to happen now is that something's up. What are we seeing here? Oh, I see what we did. Okay, so David raised his hand like an idiot. So we're going to have Jane raise her hand by clicking the appropriate icon. And everything was going so smoothly there. Jane is going to raise her hand by clicking the hand icon. And what you see appearing next to her name is the number 1, which signifies her place in line. Those of you who have seen Computer Science 50 office hours in the literal terminal room in the basement of the Science Center will know that for years, the systems the course has used is to tack a piece of paper on the wall. Students, when they have questions, just jot down their name in order. And the teaching fellows use that as a cue when we cross off your names when you've been helped. Same idea, but in a virtual context. So if multiple students are in the room, they'll simply be listed in the order in which they raise their hands so that we can offer a bit of fairness. Now, playing the role as teacher now, I'm switching back to David's laptop, I see as the teacher that one of you guys has raised their hands. So what I can now do is pull that student, Jane in this case, into what's called in Illuminate Speak a private breakout room, which essentially means to put the two of us in a folder here so that what goes on henceforth and the chatting and the sharing of windows can only be seen by David and Jane, and say not by other students that you presumably wouldn't want seeing and watching your questions and answers. So now that we're both in this room together, I'm going to switch back to the Jane view of this world. She, again, sees the same kind of thing. And Jane knows, because she's familiar with the VTR already, that the first thing she probably wants to do is to go ahead and share whatever program she's using. Now, mind you, Jane might have Facebook open in one window, but presumably she has a terminal window, secure CRT, open in another window. And she probably doesn't want to share her whole desktop for various reasons, but just this individual window. So what she's going to do, quite simply, is in the virtual terminal room. And again, that handout you received on day 1 of the class, day 0 of the class, has instructions for doing all that we're doing here. You can essentially choose from the menu or click this icon here, which is the hand holding a computer screen. You're going to get this host applications window. And what Jane is seeing is all of the windows that she has open that aren't minimized on her computer. She simply needs to choose which one she wants to share, which in this case is going to be secure CRT. Click OK. The software is going to quickly rearrange her screen to sort of optimize the viewing area. She'll be told that she's sharing this application. And now, even though Facebook is still up, the only application, to be clear, that we shared was this one. So now I'm going to change our view back to the teacher, to the David view of the world. And what David now sees is Jane's window. And it's not quite as real in that I'm just toggling back and forth on the same screen, but that is what's in fact on Jane's screen. If I now, as a teacher, besides being able to talk to Jane in the form of this chat window, actually want to be able to do something with her computer and, for instance, fix a line of code or offer some pseudocode or generally move her mouse or navigate her keyboard, what I, as the teacher, can simply do, and this, again, is not something you'll have to do, but is request control of shared applications. What Jane, that is you, the student, are going to see when someone like myself does that is a little window saying David or Thomas or Katie or whomever wants to take control or share control of your computer. Presumably, you're going to say yes at this point because you initiated the process. Assuming Jane goes ahead and says yes, nothing changes on her end. And this is going to be underwhelming because I have physical control of both of these computers. But now at my laptop, logged in as David, when I hover my mouse over the screen, notice there's a little dot, which is what I see, but the cursor, the arrow that's moving, would literally be moving on your own computer screen. And in this way, can I say, for instance here, once I scroll down to the appropriate place in the code, you missed a semicolon, something to that effect, and I can help Jane out. And granted, when your programs become more complicated, the assistance will be more useful than this, but that, in a nutshell, is the idea of the virtual terminal room. So stay tuned to the course's website for the first round of office hours that we'll be offering with regard to that. Any questions about the virtual terminal room? Yes?
Does it have the same office hours as regular office hours?
Good question. Does it have the same hours as physical office hours? No. We're going to keep it different so that we don't use the same teaching fellow necessarily who's physically trying to attend to you all personally and who would simultaneously need to then be torn by a computer. We'll have separate hours, and it will be explicit on the course's website which are traditional office hours, which are physical. It's quite cool, the software. And Henry Leitner and I tried it out essentially in one of our summer school courses this year to great success. We were even, as I may have said in the first class, able to help one of our distance students through the distance ed program who was sitting at her computer in China at the time. So the software actually works pretty well. So it should certainly work for those of you in the quad. All right, so we concluded on Wednesday with a look at some of the stuff that CS50 brings to the language of C. These are training wheels of sorts that we'll very quickly take away, but in the first week or two of the course, it's quite useful for us to be able to assume that in the language known as C, there are a couple of other data types. A Boolean, to capture the idea of true or false, as well as the idea of a string. Well, you'll recall perhaps that one of the examples we typed up the other day was something like this. Hello1.c. At first, I just said hello world, then we added these quotes. Not all that interesting, but then we introduced the idea of variables. Well, and it turns out that I can simply say something like string s equals, let's say, David, just to put my name there. And then we can actually make this a little more dynamic. What was the so-called formatting code to insert a string automatically into the printf line here? Yeah, so it was just %s, so %s. Then after commas, I start to specify the variables or values. So in this case, I'm going to put, coincidentally, s. Although, to be clear, lest there be confusion, had I labeled this a foo, then down here, I would simply label this a foo. And if I start saying ad hoc foo, bar, baz, quux, and words like this, we'll eventually tell you from whence those derive. So I'm going to go ahead and save this now. I'm going to go ahead and run GCC of hello1.c. Okay, so there's a problem here. Yeah, hands up.
You said that the string and Boolean is only CS50 specific. Mm-hmm. What if you're doing a program, not related to CS50, how would we use the Boolean in this string?
Good question. So if you're doing programs not for CS50, one, as I said, we'll quickly take the training wheels off, so to speak, so you'll be doing things the traditional way in C before long. And also know that in languages besides C, certainly after this course, more recently invented languages like Java and such actually have these Boolean, these data types built in because they redress what is otherwise for C a need. So there's these problems here, and there's a bunch of them it seems, and yet my program didn't seem all that long, but what's the first error message that's jumping out at you? It's a string undeclared, so there's some kind of failure to define it. Well, why might that be? Well, recall that the one thing you do have to include if you start using some of these CS50-specific functionalities, you need to specify that you want to include that file. That is, include the CS50 library. If I now resave this thing, go ahead and recompile hello1.c. This time it compiles. What do I type to execute this program? Yep, just a.out. And it looks like I have a working program. There's no new line, but that wasn't so much the point of this demonstration. Well, there's other things that the CS50 library brings to you in these first weeks of the course. And trust us now when we say that if we were not giving you this library and the ability to just call a function that is one of these mini programs to get user input, it would be a headache in the first week of the course because with C, because you are so close to the hardware, so to speak, it is non-trivial to just do something that conceptually is trivial, like getting input from the user. And so we provide you with a layer of abstraction, which is a theme that will, in fact, recur throughout the course in the form of these five functions for now. Get char, get double, get float, get int, and get string. All of these will prompt the user for one of those types of data. And we can see this, for instance, in the following example. In what's called hello3.c, which you do have a printout of. Notice that I did include in that topmost line of code, include the CS50 library. Now I give some sort of instructions to the user, state your name, and then I do string name equals get string. So just like printf is a function that is a little mini program that has some predetermined behavior, so does getString. But getString is a little different in that it doesn't just produce what's called a side effect. That is, it doesn't just print something to the screen, but it actually gets input from the user and then does what with it, apparently? Yeah, it sort of returns it, so to speak, as a string. So you can use this equal sign, the so-called assignment operator, to actually assign whatever value getString returns once it's run and store it, tuck it away, in the variable here called name. So functions can either return values, as with getString, or they don't return values, as in this case, apparently, printf. And we'll see many uses of these, and this is quite useful as our programs become more complicated. I'm going to go ahead and compile hello3.c. I'm going to go ahead and, oops, problem. What's wrong? So there was a lesson that we almost hit at the end, which is this. So when you're compiling CS50-specific code that uses CS50-specific libraries for now, there's one tweak you need to make to the line of code that you're executing for reasons that we will eventually unveil. Writing the program is the same using Nano or your favorite text editor. Compiling the program is almost the same because line 2 there we have seen almost before, but there's one addition. The very last thing there says hyphen LCS50. And all that's telling GCC is that when it comes time to combine the CS50 code that we wrote with the code that you wrote, look for it in the CS50 library or lib. All right. So in fact, to compile this thing, I don't want to just type this, but I want to type LCS50. But what, by the way, was the point of dash O hello 3 if I wanted to compile it like that? All right, so that just changes the name. So there's nothing too interesting there, but let's go with it. So now instead of running hello a.out, I'm going to run hello 3, and now I in fact have a prompt, and that was my prompt that I coded up. I'm going to say, okay, my name is David, enter, and now we dynamically do something with that input. So another step in a more interesting direction. Let's actually deploy at least one other of these. In adder.c, which you also have a printout of, here's maybe a more traditional mathematical approach to writing a C program. Again, underwhelming, because we could do this by hand, but this program, if you look just at the code and not at the comments up top, what's it going to do? It's just going to add two numbers. It's going to ask the user for the first number, quote unquote, give me an integer. You're going to type it. Give me another integer. Where are those going to get stored? Yeah, variables called X and Y, apparently. And notice here now that there's something to take note of. Even though I'm not using y until the second to last line of the program, in C, anytime you want to use a variable, you need to declare it, so to speak. But you must declare it at the very top of the function. So not only must you declare it by mentioning its name, you have to specify its type explicitly. So in this case, x and y are both clearly ints. Just as an aside, I could have typed this if I preferred as int x, semicolon, and then on a separate line, I could have said int y, but there are little shortcuts that you'll either see or pick up yourself. They're equivalent. But the point, though, is that all variables must be defined at the tops of your C functions. This is different for those of you from AP Computer Science from, say, C++ or Java, which are much looser when it comes to variables declarations. Just to tie together last time's discussions, here's another formatting string. Looks like we're using three of them, and then we're substituting in x, y, and then it looks like not just a variable, but an arithmetic expression that's using those variables. And so that is valid as well, so long as the end result is an int, to be in accordance with the percent %d. Yep?
How does get int handle if they don't actually input an integer?
Excellent segue. So what happens if the user sort of messes with you and doesn't, let's see, if we compile this, GCC, adder.c, lcs50, and for now I don't care about the file names, I'm just going to let a.out be my name of choice. So suppose I try to mess with this program, or I'm just not paying attention, and I say, all right, here's a letter, A, or here's a number, A. All right, well, one of the other things that the CS50 library does for you to some extent is error checking, because this too, to be frank, is a pain when you're first coding in C. And even when you're coding at C several years from now, it's still a pain to do this kind of error checking. And so that, again, is the purpose of these kinds of libraries. So what's going to happen if you fail to provide valid input? It's just going to keep prompting you until you finally do provide an integer. In this case, 0, 1, and the sum of 0 and 1 is 1. So that's another useful thing that these libraries provide for now. So those are the functions that come with the CS50 library. The takeaway for now is that if you want to use them, and you probably will have to for most of problem set one, you've got to include CS50.h at the top. And for now, and we'll automate some of this in the days to come, dash LCS50 at the very end of your GCC line. So a word on problem set one, which is online. We did not provide printouts, but rather have posted it only online so that you can choose in a self-selecting manner whether to do the so-called standard edition or the so-called hacker edition. And I learned a new trick with Microsoft Word so that we can put this watermark on every page of the hacker edition so that you know at least which one you're actually doing. Again, as we said in the first week of the course, the spirit of these is as follows. We do expect and we do encourage most of you, dare say almost all of you, to do the standard editions as students in this course have been doing for 10 or 15 years. But for those of you who really are coming to the course with a savvy that you're pretty sure is more advanced than, say, most of the students in the class because you took AP Computer Science or you taught yourself C++ when you were 6 years old, the purpose, there are some of you, the purpose of these hacker editions is to really provide these two unofficial tracks within the course. Self-selecting, up to you which route to pursue, but it's in the same spirit of those two books, for those more comfortable and those less comfortable. What we essentially do with these hacker editions is as follows. I pretty much write the standard edition first and put in it what I think is important for those, for the masses to sort of take away from the week's material. I then go back and say, all right, where can I elaborate in more arcane detail on some of what's going on in this problem set? The kinds of details that, say... And I know how to work around this. I promised my sister I wouldn't use her as my counterpoint, since she took CS 50 years ago, and so did I, clearly, and we sort of have very, she would have done the standard edition, shall we say. I'll have to edit this out of the tape now, too. But the point is that what we essentially do in the hacker editions is provide more technical detail, more sort of instruction in the way of dialogue and sort of narrative, so that those of you who like this kind of stuff and really want to navigate your way more effectively around a Unix system, which isn't necessary for the course, but is kind of cool, certainly in some's minds, that's the point of the hacker editions. And some of the problems themselves will be different. They'll cover the same material or the same spirit of material, but the problems themselves might be a bit more challenging, a bit more advanced, and the wording typically more sophisticated, and we'll just make more assumptions in the hacker edition as to what you should know how to do. We won't hold your hands as much, so to speak, in the first weeks of the class. So pull them both up, even if you're pretty sure right now that standard is for you, just so you at least have a sense of what other kinds of problems there are that you might be able to tackle. And week to week, you can choose which of these editions to bite off. Questions? Yes? Ah, good question. So if we provide an integer in using the CS50 library, say for this adder program, and I provide, say, not an integer but 2.3, it too is going to yell at you. And it's going to notice, ooh, there's a decimal point in there that's not valid. So again, it does some form of error checking for you. Good question. And I would urge you, too, when you have these questions, lecture now, asking, perfect approach. When you're not in lecture and not in, say, section, just try it out. And we can't emphasize enough how much you will learn on your own by just trying things out. You have a text editor, you have a compiler. If you're not sure how something will behave, try it out. There's no reason to try to look it up when you have a compiler at hand. What I'm going to do is invite you, if you're interested, as an at-home weekend exercise, to implement a program that converts Fahrenheit to Celsius. I've even left you a little blank space here to do so. With the building blocks we've covered thus far, will this program essentially boil down to asking the user for what? The Fahrenheit value, and then according to the formula, which I've reminded you of at the top of the file, will you presumably do a bit of mathematics, very simple ones, but the stumbling points might be, if you sit down to write this out or type it out for fun, just to test yourself, is that you're going to have to beware those integer versus floating point issues, lest everything come out to be zero if you're just throwing away remainders and such, so those kinds of things. And you'll clearly be using a printf, perhaps formatted string, so that you only show so many decimal points of precision. There is a solution to this, though, among your printouts in F2C.C. But let's take today to wrap up some of the more fundamental syntax of C and conclude on a note about problem set one, most likely, which incidentally, if this is a bit of a teaser, somehow involves Super Mario Brothers. All right. See, they're the hacker editions, the kids that just laughed. All right. So, sorry, that's the one I would do, too. So, conditions. We've seen these in Scratch. It's probably not worth time dwelling on what these things are, but just rather what they look like. So in C, as promised, you have this ability to check a condition and do something optionally. The syntax for that is as follows. Literally write if, then in parentheses you put one of those Boolean expressions, otherwise known as a condition, and then inside the open squiggly brace or open curly brace and the closing brace, can you put any number of statements? Or can you put even additional conditions Or can you put additional loops and such? The idea is precisely the same as Scratch. If you want to have multiple such conditions, you can stack them, again, in the spirit of Scratch. Let's take a look, in fact, at condition 1.c. So here, too, we have this similar, familiar setup. We're including CS50.h. The first real line of code here appears to be getting an integer from the user. What am I doing with this integer once the user types it in? Again, point out the obvious. All right, you're storing it in n. And take care to notice that we declared n because I knew in advance that I was going to use this variable at the top of the line. And even if you're, as you're writing your programs, if you don't realize you're going to need those variables, well, fine. Hit the up arrow key a few times, put it in, and you've declared your variables. And now I'm using the conditions. So I'm saying if n is greater than 0, I'm just going to print out you picked a positive number. Else, I'm going to print out you picked a negative number. But there's at least one bug in this program. Excellent. And this time it's an intentional mistake, right? Because we've made printouts, put it on the slides, and there's a version 2 of this file. So what's the bug? All right, so 0 is not handled. So we clearly need a way around this, and let's just fast forward. Sorry?
Yes, it is. It calls it negative.
Well, okay, so there's a response, but as we should know, 0 is neither positive nor negative. So, 3 branches. If n is greater than 0, print out such. Else if, and here's a use of testing for equality. And something might jump out at you. What it's sort of curious about the else if line here. So it's equals equals. And this might be counterintuitive. But recall that we've already used up the equal sign for a different concept altogether. In the previous examples, we've been assigning values to variables by way of the equal sign. Because it is, quite literally, the assignment operator. And perhaps rather counterintuitively, if you actually want to check for equality in C, you must use 2 equal signs next to each other, and that's the equals operator. So in this case, if n equals 0, we're just going to say you pick 0, else we go ahead and print out you picked a negative number. So this version will work, both conceptually and syntactically, but something's missing in comparison to the syntax that I promised we'd be using. All right, so clearly these squiggly braces, these brackets are missing. Well, it turns out in C, really for quick and dirty reasons, you can omit the squiggly braces if you only have one statement associated with a branch. In other words, I am perfectly welcome to put in a squiggly brace there and one there. It does not change the meaning or behavior of this program. But because on the blinking line I only have one statement, I actually don't need those at all. But if instead I did something like this, you picked a positive number, backslash n, and then I just wanted to say another message like, thanks for playing, this would be bad. So this would create an error because it's no longer unambiguous as to which statement should be executed with respect to that branch. And so to get this working, we would need to go back and actually include these braces. And you'll see different forms of style. This is a topic we'll come back to. You'll see in books, you'll see in my examples, the Teaching Fellows examples, that each of us has our own style. And I'll try at least to be consistent throughout lectures so as not to send mixed messages. But there's really no one way or one right way to do these things, though diehard computer scientists might disagree. It is convention to put these first squiggly brace on the same line as, say, the condition. It is also convention to put it on the next line. It is also convention to indent differently. You'll see different styles throughout the course, and before long we will start preaching either certain types of style, or at least we will start exposing you to different types of style. But ultimately, we will require that whatever approach you take to where your parentheses are, where your braces are, what your indentation looks like, that you yourselves have to be consistent with respect to yourself. And all in this for the sake of readability of code. All right, so let's run this thing. So conditions 2.c, I'm going to need to include the CS50 library because I'm getting user input. It compiles OK. I'm going to run a.out. I'd like an integer. Let's say 4. And it does seem to work for positive numbers. Let's try 0. Seems to work. Let's try -1. Seems to work as well. So again, same idea we've seen before, but in the syntax of C. All right, so what else can we do? Well, we had in Scratch these Boolean expressions, whereby something evaluates to true or false. And then you also had the idea of those Boolean ands and Boolean ors, whereby you can combine two Boolean expressions or check the value of both of them somehow using and or. Well, so can you do that in C. If you want some line of code to execute if something is true or something else is true. You don't write the word or, but instead you put two vertical bars. And if you've never used those before, they're usually roughly on top of your enter key, and you hold down shift often. So this simply means if condition is true or whatever other condition is true, do this, else do that. The equivalent for and, where you want both of them to be true, is just ampersand, ampersand. And again here, take note that we're using two such ampersands. We'll see in time, and some of you in the Hacker Edition will see that a single ampersand and a single vertical bar actually have different meaning altogether. So they'll both appear in that precedence chart from earlier this week. So let's take a look at this example, non-switch.c. So in non-switch.c, we just have another sort of play program that sort of validates the syntax for us, and it looks like the input that the user provides is going to be judged according to the magnitude of the value. So quite simply, if the user types a number between 1 and 3, it's going to say you picked a small number, else if it's between 4 and 6, medium number, 7 and 10, big number, otherwise it's going to say it's an invalid number. So here too, the conditions can layer again and again and again, as many as you want, so long as your syntax is correct. Notice too that we do have multiple Boolean expressions within each of these sets of parentheses. We're anding those expressions together so that both of them must be true. And the other new piece of syntax here is perhaps the angle bracket equal sign, which, as you can presume, means greater than or equal to, or less than or equal to, depending on the way in which you write it. So let me pause here, only because we're going quickly, but and so it's perhaps not useful to run all of these programs and tweak them, but are there any questions about syntax, about ideas that have come to mind? Yeah. Good question. Do you need to declare strings at the top of a file? Yes, as well. So they're CS50 specific, but they're still variables for our purposes. They're still types. Yeah?
Well, two vertical bars would be true if both conditions are true.
Good question. So if you use two vertical bars to combine two expressions, must both be true or must only one be true? In the conceptual sense, either this must be true or this must be true, and so that means that either or both can be true. It's not an exclusive or, which is another topic that we'll actually come back to in the context of bit manipulation before long. Other questions? Yeah?
Can you put and an or in the same statement, or how is it divided up?
Good question. So I'm actually going to punt this question back to you offline, but yes, you can do something like this, or if n is maybe greater than 10, if we're just arbitrarily now changing this program. Now we do seem to have three Boolean expressions combined, and it's for these answers that you need to look at that precedence chart that shows you the associativity, whether something's left to right or right to left. And of course, the quick and dirty way to check these things is just to try it yourself. But let me leave it as that for now. Yep, fine, last question. Will the double equals operator work for strings? Good question. No. So that's the gotcha behind, and that's the catch of using these libraries early on, is that sometimes the behavior might not work as you expect, but we're going to fix that as early as next week. You cannot compare two strings for equality by saying is S equal to T, for reasons that will soon become clear. But it does work for all of the other primitive types that we've seen, int, double, float. Although those last two, even those are a bit of a white lie. There's actually this problem in programming in general of comparing two floating point values for equality. Because you only have a finite amount of precision, it's not always possible for the computer to answer accurately which value is in fact bigger than the other one, because you might not have enough bits to express it precisely enough. But a wave of the hand for now. So there's this other bit of syntax that we do want to introduce in this context, because it's different conceptually from scratch, even though it does implement the same idea as these conditions we've seen. In C, as well as in C++ and Java, there are these constructs known as switches, which essentially are another way of implementing the idea of an if, else if, else if, else if, and so forth construct. And you can use them with primitives like ints and chars, and let's leave it at that for now. So in switch1.java, we have the following. So again, we have a very similar framework. It's still a pretty small program, even though we have lots of lines now with lots of white space, but it works as follows. If you have some value that's, say, an int or char, for simplification's purposes today, that you want to check the value of. And you want to act based on the value in that variable, but it can be any number of different values, but only a finite number of values. You know what they are. And usually for stylistic reasons, you want to use a switching construct because it just maybe looks prettier than using the equivalent if, else, just because it's more readable, maybe it's easier to maintain. It really boils down to a matter of style. Well, syntactically, what you do is this. You write switch, then in parentheses, the variable whose value you want to switch based upon. And again, it must be, for today's purposes, a char or an int. And then you enumerate line by line by line, although technically you don't need the new line characters, line by line, each of the cases with the possible values. So what this is saying is that if n equals equals 1, or n equals equals 2, or n equals equals 3, it's going to print. You picked a small number. But then break is an important new keyword to note. As you might guess, it breaks execution at that point, and the program, the computer, jumps out of what's between the squiggly braces. That is, it breaks out of this so-called switch so that none of these other cases even get looked at. Now, suppose the user's input is the number 5. Well, what happens? Well, a switch essentially works like a cascade from top to bottom. It checks the value n, which is equal to 5. Does it equal any of those first cases? No, 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 no. So the code keeps falling through, so to speak. It hits then 4. Still no. It hits 5. And at that point, it does proceed to execute whatever is actually beneath that appropriate condition until it sees a break. If, however, the user typed in, say, 11, well, we're going to fall through all the way because none of the cases are actually going to match, and we're going to hit the so-called default label, which if we really wanted to be anal, we could go ahead and say break after that. But at that point, you're so close to the end of the switch, it's meaningless. But it's not necessary, but you could put it in there anyway. So at the end of the day, if I compile this program, switch1.c with the libcs50 and run a.out, give me an integer. Let's try 11. It works as you might expect. Yeah? Around the cases, you don't need the brackets because it literally falls through line by line by line until it hits a break. Good question. Others? Yeah?
So which would be faster, trying to run this program with this switch technique or with the if-else technique?
It's a good question. Which approach would be faster to execute? Probably they're equivalent. It depends on how smart the compiler is. For one thing, it could be underneath the hood. GCC, even though these things look differently, produces the same sequence of zeros and ones. Materially, these days, you're not really going to squeeze any more performance out of the program by simply choosing a different syntax. Typically, if performance becomes an issue, and we'll soon get to this in this course as well, you need to start thinking not so much about your syntax usually, but about the overall design of the program. And thus far, these programs are really too small to even have a design component really to them, but very quickly we'll be fixed that next week. Any others? All right, so let me mention, but not dwell on, switch 2, which, if you're curious, simply shows you the same idea using a switch, but this time using another primitive, this time a char. And this program, in a nutshell, simply analyzes a user's input as to what kind of grade it is. So if the user types in a B, it's going to say, you picked a good grade, and break out of that. So this is only to demonstrate that if you want to switch based on character values, you can do so, but there is something worthy of note. So take a guess, leading question, what do you have to take care to do when it comes to the cases when they're not numeric values but characters? So you need these single quotes. So anytime you're dealing with characters in a C program, you must encase individual characters with single quotes. By contrast, when you're dealing with what we'll call strings, which are multiple characters usually, you use double quotes. And once we pull back the hood and take a look at what a string really is, you'll see why this is in fact the case or what the difference is. But chars get single quotes, strings, multi-letter sequences of characters, get double quotes. And those of you wondering about the corner case, can you have a string of just one character? Yes, and you would use double quotes, and it's different conceptually from a character. Yeah?
Just about the switch, do you need to have a default statement?
Do you need to have the
default statement?
No, you do not. So do you need to have the default statement? No, you do not. That's just the catch-all that ensures that something gets executed if that's your desired behavior. Yeah?
Do you say case one or case all three?
I'm sorry?
Do you say case one or two?
No, I don't believe so. It's got to be case, value, colon. It can be all on the same line, but no, you can't use other keywords than those. Other questions? Yep. Exactly, and that can you have you? Yes, you can have switches with variables, and that's typically the purpose. Because if you were to hard code the value inside the parentheses, then really you know what the behavior is going to be a priori. So yes, typically you would put the value of either a variable, which in and of itself is an expression, or you could put other things like even an assignment and such. But we'll see things like that in time to come. All right, so there's this last big concept that we had in Scratch, and let's take a look at the syntax for it in C. You do indeed have the ability to implement loops in C, and the syntax is perhaps the weirdest that we've seen thus far, but it will quickly become perhaps the most familiar construct that you use. If you want to deploy a loop, you have at least three ways to do so. The first of which, and perhaps the most common of which, or one of the most common, is this so-called for loop. The way a for loop is structured is like this, but rather than sort of walk through it formally, I think it's best explained by way of an example. So among your files as well this week is progress 1. The purpose of this program, actually, let me show you what it does first. Do we need that? No. So what this program does, because I wanted a program that used a loop, is it prints out percent progress until it finally gets to 100% and stops. So clearly, there's some kind of loop going on there. Or I copied and pasted a printf line 100 times, which was probably not the case. So there is indeed a loop. And notice how short the program ultimately is, even though it produces so much output. So the structure of this program, again, is identical. We've been doing a sort of boilerplate approach to this and just changing what's inside of main thus far. I know I need a variable because I need to keep track of how many times I've done something. So I declare an int I, and you'll find that declaring iterative variables like I and j and k are usually named I, j, k, just by convention. Here's the for loop. The first thing that happens in a for loop is that you specify zero or more initializations that you want to do. That is, if you want to assign a value to a variable, you start with the initializations. You then specify a condition for how long this loop should execute. This implies that this loop should iterate again and again and again so long as I is less than or equal to 100. Ignore the thing to the right, because what happens first is that the two lines of code inside the for loop begin executing right away, so long as the condition is met. And if I is equal 0 at first, it's clearly less than 100, the loop is going to go ahead and execute. And so we print out percent complete, and it looks like we're printing out percent D, percent, so that we escape that character. And then we print out the value I. Then this is a function we'll come back to next week. I didn't want the thing to just whiz across the screen too fast, so I'm sleeping for half a second each time. And using microsleep here. And then what happens at the end of a for loop is that conceptually, when you get to the closing squiggly brace, the curly brace, what happens is then the update happens. So the very last thing to happen at the end of an iteration is that your variable gets changed, if you so desire. This I++ is shorthand notation for saying this, I equals I plus 1. So that gets quickly becomes tedious to write. So most programmers will simply use the unary incrementation operator, which is just plus plus. And there's also a minus minus equivalent. They can also come before the variables, but we'll look at that in the weeks to come as well. So the end result of this program is that it iterates 100 times. On each iteration, prints a line, sleeps for half a second, and then proceeds to go again. And a slightly cooler version of this one, only because it's perhaps the closest thing to animation that we'll see thus far, is this version here. GCC of progress 2.c is going to give me another a.out, but this time it's going to look a little sexier, right? Behavior that is a little more reasonable than printing 100 different lines. And I promised we would show you at least one use for a special escape character. How did I implement that one-liner? Yeah, using backslash r instead of backslash n. So it does have its value. Well, there are other ways to implement loops. So syntactically, you can use what's called a while loop. You can get the same job done with a while loop that you can with a for loop, just like with conditions, can you achieve the same goals as switches. To some extent, which you use is a matter of style and also which looks better, which is more readable. A while loop on first glance looks simpler because there's none of those semicolons, and there's less going on in parentheses. But here's a third version of progress. In progress 3.c, we have this approach. I declare my variable at the top, but this time I know in advance where I want to start, so I say int I gets 0. And gets is the nomenclature for assignment, typically, verbally. So we've initialized I to 0, and then while I is less than or equal to 0, do the following. And this is very much like Scratch, at least in what's inside now with these braces. Do the following. Print backslash R to pull the typewriter to the left of the screen. Print out percent complete, and then the same line as before. There's this command here, fflush, which we'll come back to in the future, but it ensures that it actually gets printed and not buffered, for those of you familiar with the terms. We sleep again for half a second. And now notice with a while loop, if you want to do any sort of updates, it's totally up to you to put in that update. It can be at the start of the loop, it can be in the middle of the loop, it can be at the end of the loop, but it's ultimately up to you to put it in there, unless you want to create what's called what? An infinite loop. And if you ever do that, which you may very well do so, and you lose control of your computer, essentially, control C will usually cancel the whole program and gets you back to a blinking prompt. Yes. So we'll see examples of this, but if in a for loop you want to do multiple initializations, you just separate them with commas. So for parenthesis I equals 0, comma j equals 1, comma, and so forth. You can do it like that. Let me move on just for the sake of time here and just come up after with any remaining questions. There's this one other looping construct, which actually does have some utility, which you'll likely use, some of you, in problem set 1. In the event that you want some loop to execute at least once, and then only after you've done something once, check a condition, there's this other type of loop known as a do while. And I'll say sort of anecdotally that the do while loop tends to be useful and tends to appear when you're asking for user input, where you want the user to be prompted for something once, but then you want to check it, and if they screwed up and gave you bogus input, then you want to go again. Whereas with a while loop, you might not want to check the value first if you don't even have a value from the user just yet. So among the challenges for you in problem set 1 are to navigate your way around a Linux system a bit more, certainly if you are as of yet unfamiliar, and it will also task you with implementing some of your first programs in C, the last of which is going to ask you to implement a simplified version of the end scene of World 1-1 in Super Mario Brothers. We will see you on Monday. Okay.